The following KOPN podcast is made possible by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please consider a donation to listener-supported community radio, KOPN. You can donate securely on our website at kopn.org.
In 1913, the money power of the country was taken away from the people by constitutional privilege. It belongs with the Congress, but it was given up in the Federal Reserve Act. The Federal Reserve is no more federal than Federal Express, but yet it has the power to determine the direction of use of money in our economy.
That was Dennis Kucinich speaking on the floor of the U.S. House of Representatives last year, pointing out the
Kucinich.
Yeah, hallelujah. That's Patricia Robinette in Eugene, Oregon, author and webmeister, webmistress, and general troublemaker.
Thank you. Nobody ever called me that before.
A troublemaker? Oh, of course you're a troublemaker.
My mother. Told me that.
Well, you know, mother's always right, right? You know?
Yeah.
So I also have a political cartoon dealing with the Fed, which I think is pretty funny. You can catch the video if you Google a hilarious animated take on the Federal Reserve. It was constructed on the Extra Normal website, where people can go. You upload text to this website, and it generates cartoons for you, where the characters speak with the computer voices speak the text that you submit. So it's pretty interesting. So let me just play that right now.
Did you hear about the Fed?
No. What about the Fed?
They announced another round of the quantitative easing.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to make large asset purchases via PAMO.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to expand their balance sheet and buy treasuries.
What does that mean?
It means they are going to print a ton of money.
So why do they call it the quantitative easing? Why don't they just call it the printing money?
Because the printing money is the last refuge of failed economic empires and banana republics, and the Fed doesn't want to admit this is their only idea.
So why do they want to print the money?
Because they say we have the deflation, and the deflation is very bad.
What is the deflation?
The deflation is when prices of the things we buy go down.
Isn't that good? Doesn't it mean the people can buy more of the stuff?
Yes, but the Fed said this is bad, especially during the recession.
So they think that during the recession, when the people have less money to buy the stuff, it is bad that the prices go down?
Yes, the Fed would rather have the inflation.
So why does the Fed think we have the deflation?
Because the CPI said so.
But aren't the food prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the gas prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the healthcare costs higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't tuition prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the taxes higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the subway fares higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the stock prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
Aren't the bond prices higher than a year ago?
Yes.
So what is deflating right now?
The only thing deflating that I can see is the Fed's credibility.
Did they have a lot of credibility to start with?
No.
Why not?
Because the Fed has been wrong about every major economic development in the past 20 years.
You mean they didn't see the internet stock bubble?
No. In fact, they helped fuel the internet stock bubble.
And they didn't see the housing bubble?
No, in fact, they helped cause the housing bubble.
And they didn't see the subprime crisis?
No, in fact, they told us subprime problems were contained right before the shit hit the fan and the Lehman went bankrupt.
So has the Fed ever been right about anything?
Let me see if I can think of anything. No, nothing.
Who runs the Fed?
The Fed is run by the Ben Bernanke.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of business experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no business experience.
Does the Ben Bernanke have a lot of policy experience?
No, the Ben Bernanke has no policy experience.
Has the Ben Bernanke ever run in an election?
No, the Ben Bernanke has never run in an election.
So what qualifies him to run the Fed?
I don't know, maybe the fact that he has a nice beard.
But my plumber also has a nice beard, and I would not trust him to play God with the economy.
No, although when you call the plumber to fix something that is broken, they usually fix it, not break it more.
This is true, the plumber is clearly smarter than the Ben Bernanke.
Well, that is why he became a plumber and not an economist.
How does the Fed execute the quantitative easing?
They print the money, and then they buy the treasury bonds.
Do they buy the treasury bonds from the Treasury Department?
No, they buy the treasury bonds from the Goldman Sachs.
You must be kidding me.
No.
So let me get this straight. If I want to buy the treasury bonds with my money, I can buy them directly from the treasury.
Yes.
And if you want to buy the treasury bonds with your money, you can buy them from the treasury.
Right.
But if the Ben Bernanke wants to buy the treasury bonds using the American people's money, he does not buy them from the treasury, he buys them from the Goldman Sachs?
Exactly.
And does the Goldman Sachs give him a good price?
Of course not, they are the Goldman Sachs, they make their living ripping off the American people.
But how is the Goldman Sachs able to do this?
The Fed announces what it is going to buy, and when it is going to buy, before it does the trade.
So the Goldman Sachs can front-run the Fed, and give them the worst possible price on the treasury bonds?
Yes, exactly.
And the Fed is okay with this blatant theft from the American people?
Of course, otherwise, the Fed would just buy the treasury bonds directly from the Treasury Department.
Who inside the Fed is responsible for the buying of the treasury bonds?
The buying of the treasury bonds is conducted by the New York branch of the Federal Reserve.
And who is in charge of the New York branch?
The head of the New York branch is the William Dudley.
And what did the William Dudley do before running the New York Fed?
Before running the New York Fed, the William Dudley was a partner at the Goldman Sachs.
So the guy in charge of the American people's money when dealing with the Goldman Sachs used to be a partner at the Goldman Sachs?
Yes.
And nobody has a problem with this?
Apparently not.
Is this an episode of The Twilight Zone?
I don't think so.
Are you sure?
Pretty sure.
So what you are telling me is that the Fed thinks prices are going down, when in fact they are going up?
Yep.
And they think during the recession, with the high unemployment, it is better if the thing people need to buy cost more money.
Correct. According to the Ben Bernanke, the inflation will create the jobs and improve the housing market.
Has this ever been tried before?
Yes, just last year the Fed tried the quantitative easing with $2 trillion.
Did that create the jobs?
No.
Did it help the housing market?
Not at all.
Did it help anybody at all?
Yes, it helped the Goldman Sachs.
How much of the money are they printing now?
$600 billion.
So even though the first $2 trillion did not create the jobs or improve the housing market, the Fed decided to do another $600 billion anyway?
Yes.
Who put the Ben Bernanke in charge?
The Ben Bernanke was first appointed by the President Bush, then he was reappointed by the President Obama.
But wasn't the President Obama supposed to bring the change?
Yes.
How is putting in charge the same fool who has been wrong about everything the change?
Well, under the President Bush, the Ben Bernanke only blew up the American economy. Under the President Obama, he is working on blowing up the entire global economy.
That does not sound like the change we can believe in.
Definitely not.
Who else supports the Ben Bernanke?
Most economists around the world think the quantitative easing is very dangerous.
Does anyone think it is a good idea?
Yes, the people at the Goldman Sachs.
Is this some kind of nightmare?
No, it is very real.
I want to bang my head against the wall.
You should not do that.
Why not?
Because the healthcare is too expensive.
But didn't the President Obama fix that?
No, but that is the subject of a whole other video.
I thought that was pretty amusing.
I mean, it's really sad, but it's very well done.
It's
cartoon.
It's tragic. I mean, what we're talking about here is just unbelievable poverty. I mean, just a total treasonous ripoff of the United States.
Yeah. I just put a sign on the elephantintheliveringroom.org, and it says, "We can't feed the poor, but we can fund a war."
Yeah, I think
our money is being really misused. Really misused.
We're being milked. I mean, this has nothing to do with the national interest, has nothing to do with people's even basic necessities. This
really
has to do
with
mass theft and treason.
Yes, it's just taking the money out of the hands of the poor and putting it into the hands of the rich. It's reverse Robin Hood. Catherine Austin Fitz calls it the looting of America, a financial coup d'etat. So it's really treason, you know?
So who is behind all this? I think there's an interesting little bit of information exposed on the Council on Foreign Relations website. There's a lot of stuff on the Council on Foreign Relations website that most people would find pretty shocking and revealing about the machinations going on behind the scenes. This is just a brief excerpt of a speech given by James Jones. He was Obama's national security advisor until just a few weeks ago. He made remarks at a conference in Munich put on by the it's Conference on Security Policy in 2009. He says, quote, "Thank you for that wonderful tribute to Henry Kissinger yesterday. Congratulations. As the most recent National Security Advisor of the United States, I take my daily orders from Dr. Kissinger, filtered down through General Brent Scowcroft and Sandy Berger, who is also here. We have a chain of command in the National Security Council that exists today. I think my role today is a little different than you might expect. Following the speech of the Vice President and the presence of our distinguished members from the U.S. Council of Representatives, House of Representatives, I thought I would spend my time talking to you about how, taking the President's guidance and the Vice President's comments yesterday, I would spend a few moments trying to discuss how the U.S. National Security Council intends to reorganize itself in order to be supportive." It doesn't say supportive of what. "For decades, this conference in Munich has provided a truly exceptional forum for the kind of open dialogue and candid discussions that can only take place among very close friends and allies." And he goes on about what great friends they are. You know, people need to understand that the social networking that goes on at the top of the pyramids, the respective national, nation, governmental pyramids, has nothing to do with their welfare. This is they're being treated as cattle, and their governments. You know, this is a global phenomenon. The governments are merging. The governments at the top of the heap have a lot more in common with each other than they do with their respective populations.
Well, they figure that we're just going to lay back in our sofas with our remotes and just let it happen, you know.
I mean, Obama's supposed to be, you know, hope and change, but here Henry Kissinger is giving marching orders to Obama's national security advisor.
Oh, God.
through Brent Scowcroft, who was National Security Advisor under George Bush the First's administration. So, you know, this the Democrat Republican thing is an illusion. There is no real difference between the two. The people who actually control things behind the scenes are the people who can afford to buy that kind of power. And I'm talking about the same people and the same group, the social grouping and economic grouping, as the people who control the Federal Reserve.
Big money.
Yeah.
Big money.
Deep money. Pockets.
They can afford to buy governments and...
Yeah.
Oh.
So...
Media...
I also have a speech, and I think I need to get into it because it's like, well, it's 45 minutes long. So this is speech by Peter Phillips, former director of Project Censored, speaking at a 9/11 truth convention in Chicago in 2006. And I think it needs to be noted that Project Censored has apparently been blacklisted from Democracy Now! And most of the other so-called left media ever since they began talking about 9/11 truth issues. And it's not the only issue which can't be raised on the Eastern establishment left media. The benevolence of the medical establishment also seems to be above reproach, specifically with regard to obstetrical abuse and circumcision and the Federal Reserve scam. The left seems to be at least as enamored with unaccountable authorities as the right, although even Fox News is now beginning to raise questions about 9/11 and false flag operations in general.
Well, if anyone wants some just general articles about all those kinds of things, then the elephantinthelivingroom.org has lots and lots of different articles that are very user-friendly. I can't wait to hear this talk. Sounds really good.
Yes, this Peter Phillips, you know, is a sociologist and media activist, this is based on a paper which was produced by a couple of graduate students at Sonoma State back in the several years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes for interesting listening.
Great.
I'm director of Project Censored. And we're a media research group that for 30 years is putting out a list of the most important news stories that the corporate media hasn't covered. So that got us interested in 9/11 unanswered questions right away. Our book in 2003, which came out actually just about a year after 9/11, listed everything that we'd seen at that point that looked like very serious, well-documented, unanswered questions. And we took that even further last year in our book, which is the one that's out right now, 2006. This has a full chapter, Unanswered Questions of 9/11, and it talks about Otis Money and Building 7 and all of those things, most of which they're pretty familiar with. One thing that became interesting to me early on and fit into the kind of research I do, I do political research about power elites, and have looked at higher class policy councils and groups in the U.S. who kind of are the decision makers, the ones making the decisions in the United States. And I've traced their histories and looked at a long 100-year history of post-industrialization and policy councils and going back to the national manufacturers and then the Trilateral Commission, all these different groups. And they're all interesting. They're all elite policy planning groups. But what's happened relative to 9/11 and before is a significant shift in the power base within the policy groups in the United States. So we started kind of a network analysis where we take a look at who the beneficiaries are from 9/11, who were the advocates before. We look at the history of the neocons, and we put together a list, which is available here, and it's on our website at projectcensored.org. of 240 key players in what we call the global dominance group. And the global dominance group is somewhat different because after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and the deterioration of the Soviet Union, this whole fear of communism, which had galvanized the policy elites in this country since World War II, went away rather quickly. And there was a real push at that time to decide, well, where do we go from here, and what have been our strategies? Our strategy has always been detente, mutually assured destruction between the Soviet Union and the U.S., statesmanship and that. And thus, so we see an emergence then where the leadership class in the United States becomes dominated by a neoconservative group of people who have a shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. So our research identifies the key actors in this global dominance group, examines how they are interconnected, how they are supported by the corporate media, and how these key newsmakers use public relation firms to put their agendas out. And we review who benefited from after 9/11, and we examine how Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld as the most public figures of this group, but how they're interlocked in public-private partnerships with the corporate media, with private foundations, the military contractors, policy elites, government officials, and that collectively, in a very tight group, they support the U.S. military global domination of the world. And so this is why we call them Global Dominance Group. Now, Wolfowitz, Alan Bloom, Richard Perle, they came out of Chicago's Committee on Social Thought, Leo Strauss, and had this neoconservative philosophy. They were few in number. But the philosophy is somewhat interesting. I want to give some examples of that. Adbusters magazine defined neoconservatism as the belief that democracy is best defended by an ignorant public pumped up on nationalism and religion. And only a militantly nationalist state can deter human aggression. And such a nationalism requires an external threat, and if one cannot be found, it must be manufactured. So this belief, that the people of the country will go along with and want to defend our nationalism is very present. And John Pilger wrote, he had actually interviewed Richard Perle back during the Reagan administration. And this is his quote. He said, "I interviewed Perle when he was advising Reagan. And he spoke about total war." This was back then. "And I mistakenly dismissed him as mad." He was writing this about 2 years ago. And he said, "And recently he used the term in describing America's war on terror. No stages," Perle said. "This is total war. We're fighting a variety of enemies. There are lots of them out there. All this talk about we're going to do Afghanistan and we'll do Iraq, and it's entirely wrong. We just let our vision of the world go forth. We embrace it entirely. We don't try to piece together clever diplomacy. We just wage total war. Our children will sing great songs about us in the future." So that's Perle. 10 years ago, during the Reagan administration. So clearly within that, and when Bush was elected to the presidency, then Cheney became Secretary of Defense, Bush the first. And so the expansion, the neoconservatives were starting to be placed in power, in positions of power within the government, within Bush the first administration. And by 92, Cheney, using Lewis Livy and Paul Wolfowitz and other writers, had produced what was called the Defense Planning Guidance Document. This was an internal memorandum circulated with the Pentagon and in high government officials that advocated the U.S. military dominance of the globe in a new world order. That's when that terminology first started. If you remember Bush talking about a new world order back during Gulf War I, that was kind of the origin of it. This new world order, U.S. military, to dominate the world. And it called for the words we hear today: unilateral action, forward presence of troops worldwide, and the U.S. was to dominate friends and foes alike, so that we'd be stronger, literally, militarily, than anybody else in the world. Even if they're our friends, you don't know that, maybe the French next year won't go along with what we want. So anybody, we needed to be stronger so that we could threaten literally anybody in the world. Well, the Defense Policy Guidance Document was leaked to the press. And, you know, and people were kind of in shock about it. The New York Times wrote on March 11, 92, that senior White House and State Department officials have harshly criticized a draft Pentagon policy statement that asserts America's mission in the post-war era, prevent any collective friendly or unfriendly nations from competing with the United States for superpower status. So the New York Times is saying, hey, this isn't a good idea. Bush kind of backs off on that as a strategy. And then, of course, Clinton, who was never supposed to get elected, got elected. And so these guys are basically out of government. There were some neocons, Woolsey and others, within the Clinton administration, but it wasn't a predominant thing. So Clinton kind of stays away from promoting global dominance as an ideological justification for continued high defense budgets. Remember, in the early 90s, there was this talk of, you know, Cold War dividend, you know, that we were going to have money for schools and for the economy, and that didn't last very long. But, you know, the defense spending went down a little bit. It dipped a little bit. And Cheney had actually did that. It was symbolic. But we see kind of a maintenance. But Clinton's strategy for helping the defense contractors at that time was to actively pursue the expansion of U.S. weapons sales worldwide. So we went from 16% of the international weapons sales in 1988 to 63% in 97. Remember Ron Brown before they got his airplane? And I mean, he was going around promoting arms sales for the defense contractors all over the world. The neoconservatives, you know, they were still very active during the Clinton administration, but most of them ended up in various conservative think tanks or working for Department of Defense contractors. So they moved into the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hoover Institute, GENSA, the Jewish Institute for National Security, Center for Security Policy, and others. And so they're employed there. They're working, writing papers, and doing advocacy for the continued military New World Order advocates. And then, you know, AEI and some other core foundations, American Enterprise Institute, funded the Project for New American Century to kind of galvanize some of this energy in June of 97. So their founding statements, principal statements, kind of reads like a kind of a neocon, you know, world philosophy. We need to increase defense spending. That's kind of core idea number one. To carry out our global responsibilities, we need to strengthen our ties with allies and to challenge regimes hostile to us. We need to promote the cause of political and economic freedom abroad. And we need to accept responsibility for America's unique role in preserving and extending the international order friendly to our security, prosperity, and principles. So this is, you know, protect American corporations anywhere in the world, essentially. And it was kind of this declaration. So when PNAC is founded, there was 25 people who signed that original statement of what they were about. Elliot Abrams, Gary Bauer, Jeb Bush, Cheney, Ilya Cohen, Calizad, Libby, Dan Quayle, Wolfowitz, Rumsfeld, some of the names we know publicly now. But, you know, there was 25 people. 12 of them went right into positions with Bush the second. And so they were lining up, they were ready, and that. It took them 3 years to put out the defense strategies for Resource for New Century. That's a document that is often referenced as PNAC's document, the Strategy for a New America Defense. That came out in September of 2000. But they put a number of other policy statements out in that time period and were very active. What's interesting is they're interconnected with the, you know, a dozen key policy groups in the country. So this was a new group formed, but it was coming together with energy from a variety of sources. So it wasn't just these 25 guys getting together and say it's time to do this. So the defense policy guidance document was actually written by Libby and Wolfowitz in 92. It looks very much like what came out of the PNAC in 2000. I mean, some of the language is the same. They use some of the same kinds of adjectives and verbs. And the PNAC one was, as Steve Carbone was in on that, and a number of others who went on to have high positions in the current administration. So that rebuilding American defenses called for homeland protection. We start to get that use of the word homeland, homeland security, homeland protection. The ability to wage simultaneous wars anywhere in the world, to have a global policing role. In other words, we're going to be the police force for the world. To be able to control space, weapons in space, the weaponization of space, and to be able to make those kinds of, literally, I mean, they would love to be able to melt Gaddafi as he was giving a speech somewhere with a satellite beam, you know. And they still have these visions of that kind of Star Wars weapon control, better than anybody else has got. You know, we see the drones and we see that kind of stuff, and that's kind of the beginning. But they have this technology dream. And they also want to control cyberspace. And they just said that right away. I mean, they want to be able to control the information flow in the internet and that around the world. And then they said that the 90s was a decade of neglect, and the U.S. must increase its military power to preserve a Pax Americana. In other words, we're going to impose peace on the world, and we're going to do that militarily. So we've got 700 bases with forward deployment of troops worldwide. And they identified very specifically Iran, Iraq, North Korea, and particularly China. They spent a good bit of time talking about China. Containment of China. China's the major threat. And making sure that we will always have military dominance and being able to, control China. So, and they said that, you know, this is going to be a problem because the American people aren't really tuned into, you know, having an empire and global military domination. And we don't even talk about it like that. I mean, they didn't want to talk about it like that. But, you know, they said that that's not going to happen. And then, of course, the famous words, unless there's a new Pearl Harbor. So they're laying that right out. And, of course, 9-1-1 gave us that catastrophe to which they were able to maximize this philosophy and continue military expansion and grow. So we looked at who are the beneficiaries from this process. You can identify who the people are advocating for global dominance. You look at who the beneficiaries are, and then you start to put the names of the people that run those boards of directors together in a group and as a list. They all know each other. I mean, they go to different meetings and they talk. I mean, these people, if you're on a board of directors of a major defense contractor, you know all the players. And there's not that many. I mean, our list covers about 240 people. And we show the interlocks between the various groups and who they are. So we looked at the key advocacy groups, PNAC being one, but also the Hoover Institute, the American Enterprise Institute, the Hudson Institute, the National Security Council, Heritage Foundation, the Defense Policy Board, the Committee on the Present Danger, the second one in terms of the one about Iraq, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs, the Manhattan Institute, Committee on the Liberation of Iraq. That was during Clinton's administration with Bruce Jackson, and they put together this committee advocating the invasion of Iraq back then. The Center for Security Policy, the Center for Strategic and International Studies, the National Institute for Public Policy, and the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC. So those groups, those 15 groups, are kind of the core philosophical supporters for the PNAC, and money, too, that went in. And you look at individuals who are giving speeches to these groups or people coming out of them doing policy position statements and that. You know, these groups, their core elements are closely interlinked with the top defense contractors in the country. Here's a quote from Condoleezza Rice, and she's speaking at the Hoover Institute in 2000. She's saying, you know, as the world's leading superpower, the United States has special responsibilities. I like to think about this as a great train that's moving down the track. And the metaphors that get used here are interesting. There's markets and competition for private capital. And Rice is saying, clearly, the United States is kind of in the conductor's seat. And with this position of leadership, we have this responsibility to keep the peace. So, you know, it's kind of quaint, but it's like, okay, we've got to have a military that's going to rule the world. I mean, that's essentially what she's saying. And this gets manifested more overtly. We looked at Dick Cheney's speech to the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, just in March. On March 7th, he gave a keynote speech to the AIPAC meetings. And this is kind of a telling example of the neoconservative global dominance thought in the current administration. Kind of his, this is his exact words. Israel and the U.S. and all civilized nations will win the war on terror. And to prevail in this fight, we must understand the nature of the enemy. As America experienced on September 11, 2001, the terrorist enemy is brutal and heartless. The enemy wears no uniforms, has no regard for the rules of warfare. Now, this is Cheney. Is unconstrained by any standard of decency or morality. And the terrorists, now this is the part that's incredibly interesting. The terrorists want to end all American and Western influence in the Middle East. Their goal in that region is to seize control of a country so they have a base from which to launch their attacks and wage war against governments that do not meet their demands. Ultimately, to establish a totalitarian empire that runs from southern Spain, across North Africa, through the Middle East, through India and Pakistan, all the way to Indonesia. This is what the terrorists want to do. And you get the it's a little ironic. And so, you know, and they're trying to build this. So Cheney, you know, he's claiming that there's all these evil terrorists everywhere. They're plotting for the ruin of civilized nations. And that we've got to stop them militarily by controlling all the regions that they're threatening. So this forward deployment, global domination, is clearly written in there. It's designed, you know, we've created this terrorist enemy. And to prevail over totalitarian terrorists, you know, we have to have U.S. domination of the world. Now, when we look back at this, and the early neocons and that, you know, for the last 30 years, there's been really only about 14 foundations that have funded, been the main funders for these groups, for the Heritage, for the, Hoover has been around for a long time, but AEI. And in the past 30 years, $177 million has gone to fund the policy directives of the global dominance group people. 96% of that money came from 10 families controlling 14 foundations. So we're talking about Scafee, we're talking about Bradley, Orlin, and a dozen others, which we list in our paper and that. So it's a narrow group of funders with some big bucks putting in millions of dollars to key groups. And so we see greater evidence of this kind of conversation. So we see an emergence where the leadership class in the United States becomes dominated by a neoconservative group of people who have a shared goal of aggressively asserting U.S. military power worldwide. Our research identifies the key actors in this global dominance group, examines how they are interconnected, how they are supported by the corporate media, and how these key newsmakers use public relation firms to put their agendas out. And we review who benefited after 9/11. And we examine how Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld as the most public figures of this group, but how they're interlocked in public-private partnerships with the corporate media, with private foundations, the military contractors, policy elites, government officials, and that collectively, in a very tight group, they support the U.S. military global domination of the world. We're here in Chicago. As we're speaking, it is 9:10 in the morning in California. The Bohemians are having breakfast. And they're having breakfast out at the Bohemian Grove in Monte Rio on the Russian River in Sonoma County. There's probably about 2,000 to 3,000 of them there right now. And so they're there thinking about these issues. Probably will have something to do with Iran or national security or issues along that. I mean, right now we're saber-rattling about Iran quite a bit. I attended the Grove in June of 1994. I heard this speech, and it was given, and this was a lakeside chat, And I took copious notes. You can't record anything there, but I took copious notes. I was doing my dissertation on them. So I actually got in and got to listen and hear the kinds of conversations that policy elites have. And it was very interesting. But they had a speaker there, and it was representative to me of the neoconservative agenda that was kind of going on and being advocated for at that time, that's manifested itself, 10, 12 years later. He was a University of California political science professor. His title was Violent Weakness. And he said that there's increasing violence in society that's weakened our social institutions. Just think, there's 2,000, 3,000 guys sitting in front of this lake. There's no women allowed. And they're 99% white. And they're mostly middle-aged or older. And there's some, one out of three is somebody really important in the country. I mean, they're CEOs of major corporations. And now, I mean, Bush is a member. And, Bush Sr. is a member. They haven't let George in yet, George W., but they will probably. And so, these are some really important people. So the speaker's saying that our social institutions are being weakened, and this is caused by bisexualism, entertainment politics, multiculturalism, Afrocentrism, and a loss of family values and boundaries. And he says, to avert further deterioration, we need to recognize that elites, based on merit and skill, are important to society. And any elite that fails to define itself will fail to survive. We need boundaries and values set very clear. We need American-centered foreign policy. A president who understands foreign policy. It was Clinton bashing. There was a lot of Clinton jokes there then. He went on to conclude that we cannot, and this is a quote, we cannot allow the unqualified masses to carry out policy that elites must set values that can be translated into standards of authority. So that's that philosophy, and that gets, portrayed, and it was a standing ovation, and 3,000 guys stood up and were cheering and clapping. And at the time, I don't think I had appreciated the degree to which, this global dominance agenda was kind of emerging within the higher policy circles in the United States. So who benefits from this? Who are the people that are benefiting, and how does that manifest in terms of profit margins and that kind of thing? I want to mention one thing. We put together this list of people and we identified all their, I had a couple of students. We worked all last summer, and a lot of this data will be in David Ray Griffin's book that will come out in September, the U.S. Post-American Empire, Post-9/11 American Empire, which will be his new book. And we had a variation of this that was published on our website at projectcensored.org. So it puts together things like William Barr. He's on the Carlyle Group board. And, who else he's connected with? He's on the Heritage Foundation. He's in the Hoover Foundation. He was a PNAC person, PNAC. He's on the Council of Foreign Relations. He's an NSA person. And he was a former congressional assistant to Reagan. So you get these people in these high-level positions. It's kind of like a high school yearbook, and they're all in these different groups, and you can go through it. You can see, well, this person's only in two of them, and this person's in eight of them. But they still all know each other. And so that's typical. And I don't know how many of you ever heard of William Barr, but I mean, he's one of the people that are making these policy decisions. And I just picked him for random because he was kind of in the middle group of having some people are in everything, literally. I mean, you look at Cheney, and you look at Lynn Cheney, of course, is on the Lockheed Martin board of directors, and then she's very active in the AEI, American Enterprise Institute. So who profits from this global dominance policy? So we looked at that question, and we looked at the top defense contractors. I had my political sociology course. Each student took one of the defense contractors and did a full who's on their board and what's their profit margin. They did these nice charts. It was really fun. And we took some of that data from that, and then we refined it a bit. And so Lockheed Martin has probably been one of the big beneficiaries from post-9/11 expansion. Their sales rose by 30% from 2000 to 2001 to 2004. And their stock value went up 300%. So it was a substantial increase. Northrop Grumman, same thing. Mass big stock increase. DoD contracts in 2001, $3.2 billion. In 2004, $11.1 billion. So quadrupling. Halliburton, where Cheney was former CEO, has seen phenomenal growth. Halliburton had $400 million in government contracts in 2001. 2 years later, they had $4.3 billion. So, and it's cumulative. I mean, you know, they just got the contracts to build more detention centers in the United States. So, Homeland Security huge amounts of money. And so their stock, I mean, Cheney had options on 400,000 shares of Halliburton stock, which at one point was really only worth less than a buck a share. After 9/11, it's now worth about $8 million. So he had this several million dollar increase in value of just the stock he had, and he still gets a couple hundred thousand a year and as a retirement benefit from Halliburton. The Carlyle Group, which we know George Sr. was in, a number of others have been consultants and involved with that for a long time worldwide. You know, they have $30 billion in assets. They're a kind of a money management firm. And a very large number of people in the Global Dominance Group are part of them. Carlucci, Bush, Baker, Kennard, Richard Darman. They purchased United Defense in 97, and after 2001, they sold it for $1 billion profit. So that worked real well for them. So profits for defense contractors are so good that the New York Times in May of 2005 said they got too much money. They're sitting on like $30 billion. What are they going to do with it? They really said this is a problem. Even Boeing at that time had $6.5 billion of cash. So huge amounts of cash have flown into these contractors and top corporations. So we took the top seven defense contractors that had more than a third of their income from defense contracts. So it's a vital piece of their business to be aware of what the policies are in terms of the U.S. We added in Halliburton and Carlyle because of their political connections. Take someone like GE. Their defense contracts are really only about 5% of their business. I mean, they're just a huge conglomerate. They own NBC, and I mean, they're huge, but it's not as vital to their business overall, the defense contracts. If you look at Raytheon, Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, their contracts with the government are vital to the success and the continuing success of those corporations, which is the reason why Lockheed Martin gave to two-thirds of the people in Congress. I mean, two-thirds of the people in Congress received donations from Lockheed Martin in the last congressional election in 2004. So they're deeply involved and very interested in the political process. We list the board of directors of those corporations and the policy council groups and the people in that have been advocating for this, and that's kind of how we put that network together. Now, part of that network also includes direct connections with the corporate media in the U.S. A network analysis of the boards of directors of the top 10 media organizations shows that there's really only 118 people, you darn near fit in this room, that run the corporate media in the U.S., MSNBC, ABC. You know, if you look at their board of directors, we've got 118 individuals. They, in turn, sit on the corporate boards of 288 national and international corporations. So there's this direct interconnect between the media and the big corporations throughout the United States. When we say media today, it's corporate media. I mean, you literally mean that. They're interconnected with the biggest corporations in the U.S. But they're also, and this is relatively new, very much interconnected with this Global Dominance Group. So William Kennard from the Carlyle Group sits on the New York Times board. He was also former FCC director. Douglas Warner III, who's on Bechtel's board, is also sits on GE and NBC's board. John Bryson from Boeing is on Disney's board, ABC. Alwyn Lewis from Halliburton is on ABC's board as well. And Douglas McCorkendale from Lockheed Martin sits on the Gannett board. So you got half of the top 10 with somebody directly from a big defense contractor sitting on the board of director of big media groups in the country. So this media interlock effectively represents corporate America's interests, and the media has responded to this. So we actually measured the numbers of sites by two of the key global dominance advocacy groups, American Enterprise Institute. The New York Times had 55 quotes in 2000 from AEI. And then after 9/11 in 2005, they had 99 quotes. So that was like an 80% increase. And the Washington Post, same thing. 87 quotes from AEI. In 2005, 157. It's like every other day, AEI gets in the Washington Post to is quoted on some issue that's going on. The Center for Strategic and International Studies, New York Times cited them 25 times in 2000, 61 times in 2005. Washington Post, 54 times in 2000, 81 times in 2005. So these global advocacy organizations are getting more sites, more coverage, and they are represented more in the corporate media in terms of their points of view. So that was interesting. I mean, that was certainly something new relative to that. And, you know, and we took a look specifically at Iran and going ahead with a war against Iran, you know, this whole idea that, you know, Iran's going to get the bomb and that there will be a... I mean, this was Bolton's quote. Iran is like 9/11 with a nuclear option. And Rice called Iran the number one terrorist state in the world. This all happened in the same week. Rumsfeld, Bush, all of them. What we found also was that in terms of LexisNexis and newspaper coverage, in 2000, Iran was mentioned 250 times in the major papers in the U.S. This year, it's been 890 times. Negative, I mean, that Iran is a danger. So we've seen a significant increase since 9/11 in terms of coverage of identifying Iran. And the PNAC was saying Iran's the bad guys, you know, 10 years ago. So they're continuing with that agenda. But they have help. And their help is public relation firms. This was remarkable to us because I didn't really know this until about a year and a half ago. Public relations industry, since 9/11, has seen phenomenal growth and massive mergers, massive consolidation. So there's three large publicly traded mega corporations now, Omnicom, WPP, and Interpublic Trust. These firms employ 163,000 people, over 170 countries, and they are a network of they control a massive amount of wealth, interconnected with the most powerful institutions in the United States, corporate and government. And they have direct connections within the global dominance group, the multinational corporations, and the policymaking groups. So, like WPP is a UK-based conglomerate, and they make up Young and Rubicon, Burston Marsteller's, Oakley and Mather Worldwide, Helen Knowlton. Remember the incubator babies in the first Gulf War? Well, that was a Helen Knowlton story. And with a number of other PR, advertising, and crisis management firms all over the world. So this control of media, control of the ideas that are being presented, are going through these massive firms. There's a number of independents, but they're clearly, you know, keenly interlocked. WPP groups, they have four of their members on the Council of Foreign Relations. Omnicom has a position on Time Warner. And Omnicom has somebody on a lifetime member of the PBS board. So they're closely interlocked. And this is management of information and news. So and then there's a number of notable, and some like the Lincoln Group, which we've heard about. But you don't hear a lot about the Rendon Group unless you follow war news. I mean, well, they don't like say that they're making the war news, but they do. Rendon Group is the company that has worked since the 80s, managing the images of Americans' imperial wars. They worked for Bush. They handled Serbia. The first big one was the invasion of Panama. And so they shaped the international support for the first Gulf War. They actually created the Iraqi National Congress and handpicked Ahmad Shalabi to be the head of that. I mean, they got CIA money to do that.
Wow, talk about friends in high places. So this is just a glimpse into the power structure that wields the real power behind the scenes. It has nothing to do with presidents and congressmen. Congress is largely a rubber stamp organization at this point. If you talk to the aides, you call up aides of congresspeople and senators and ask if they are familiar with such and such an issue, you know, have they done any research into this before they signed the bill and so on. They don't even read the bills half the time before they sign them. These bills are assembled, you know, put together by lobbyists. So, you know, this is the definition of fascism. So,
what a pity.
Well, we do have the means of spreading the word, and, you know, truth is on our side, facts are on our side, patriotism is on our side. People with an enlightened understanding of what it means to be an American, to support the Constitution, to have an understanding of what national security is really all about, know that these people are traitors, and they need to be exposed as traitors. And just because an organized crime syndicate wraps itself in the flag doesn't mean they're above reproach, even, any more than medicine wrapped itself in white coats and tortures babies upon their arrival on this planet doesn't make them above reproach. And common sense and humanity will prevail in the end. But the sooner that people start waking up to these issues, the better.
Boy, it's overwhelming, isn't it?
Well, a lot of people...
It's big.
Yes, it's big. It's big in power, but that power is based, again, on lies and deception. And even at the level of this grove in California, what is it called? Bohemian Grove. You know, they talk about how the masses need the elites in order to steer them properly. But what is destroying the mass culture in this society? It's being destroyed by the mass media and by public education, which is just a farce. You know, what passes for public education these days? They aren't educating anyone. They're indoctrinating children on how to take orders, how to do drugs, how to be miserable. Essentially, kids are coming out of high school without being able to add fractions. This is a farce, and it's all being supervised by the hierarchies of power, which are largely concentrated in New York and Washington. So, even these elites in Bohemian Grove are being marketed to and lied to by the people, the real powers behind the scenes, the money masters, who can buy this kind of influence, you know, just by process of elimination. It's not even necessary to trace the network of control here. You can just ask yourself, who has the ability to buy this kind of influence? And when you say the word buy, you know, that pretty much narrows it down pretty substantially.
And those large amounts of money are pretty seductive to people in positions of power.
There's a lot of loops here because some of those most pathological personalities are attracted to these kind of structures. So the next show is waiting in the wings, and I hope people have found this enlightening and even humorous at times.
Can I say one more little thing?
Certainly.
The military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned America about and that this gentleman was talking about in his speech, and Hightower was talking about in the little blurb before this show, really needs to just be retooled. You know, if the American people were to just retool the military-industrial complex, then the stockholders wouldn't have to lose money. They could just, instead of using all the resources to make war and to kill people and to destroy the whole world, we could use it to build a really healthy world where plants can grow and water is changed from salt water to water that can be put on crops, and people could be healthy all over the globe if we were to retool our military industrial complex.
This is a vastly wealthy country, and there's no reason why we can't use this wealth for the benefit of the people. So,
yep.
With that, I think we have to go.